Welcome, everyone, to episode 362 of the NBA podcast. I'm Brian Toporek, and today we're going to catch up on the latest in the conference finals, discuss the Chicago Bulls' new head coach, and touch on the MVP race that just concluded the other day. Before we get into all of that, a reminder, you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some five-star reviews. And we're being hosted by Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Joining me today, as always, is a man who needs to get very acquainted with Billy Donovan. Morten Jensen, how's it going?
It's going well, Brian. I'm 34 years old, and my back just gave out today, so I'm on a lot of painkillers.
Good. 34 going on 78. I'm proud of you.
Yep.
We are also joined by a very special guest, Matt Moore, the senior NBA writer at the Action Network. Matt, how is it going?
Going well, you know, for the global pandemic and social unrest and general downfall of democracy. Other than that, though, things are going well.
Right. Aside from all of 2020, that's good to hear. Thank you for joining us. Before we get into all of this fun stuff, can you let our listeners know where they can find you on Twitter and any work you'd like to promote?
Sure. You can find me on Twitter at HP Basketball. The biggest thing I want to promote is our Action Network app. It is the absolute best way to track scores. Like, it lets you track your bets. You get all sorts of great information, but it also lets you track scores the fastest. I've actually timed it against the TV broadcast. Our feed updates before the TV broadcast comes through. So if you want up to the second sports information, you need to check out the Action Network app.
Nice. Yes, please do. I've been noticing that, like, on Twitter, the reporters who are on scene are tweeting faster than the TV broadcast and, like, even the scorecast on ESPN and everything. So now I'm trying to not be on Twitter. I need to, like, mute some of these people so
Gary,
I don't get a
Gary
spoiler.
Gary Washburn, who I love and is a great writer in Boston, he's the worst at it. Like, he's just the worst at it. He's just like, because he just does play-by-play stuff, so he'll be like, another Dragic three, and I'm like, wait, what?
Yeah, right. Yeah, I feel like Tim Reynolds of the Associated Press, I'm getting the same things from him. So, yes, I guess if you want the spoiler before you actually see it, the Action Network app will be the perfect way for you to find out if you're winning money. So, guys, we got a lot to cover today. Let's start with the Western Conference Finals. We just saw Game 3 last night. The Nuggets got out to a 20-point fourth-quarter lead and then tried to Sixers it up and just completely choke it away. But Jamal Murray made some big plays late, hit a couple big threes, and a clutch pass to Paul Millsap to seal the game, give us a series. And honestly, I mean, if not for Anthony Davis's last-second three at Game 2, this could very easily be 2-1 Nuggets. So, Matt, I know you cover the team pretty closely. What were your impressions going into this series, and then what has anything changed given what you've seen in these first couple games?
Yeah, quite a bit, I think, has changed. First off, I do want to point of order. Giving up those kind of double-digit leads is actually called Clippersing. That's actually what it's become known as now. So I think here's the big thing. I didn't think that Denver would be able to match the physicality of the Lakers, because the Clippers are kind of, to be honest, they're kind of fake tough, and that was why I picked the Nuggets over the Clippers. The Lakers are genuinely big, physical, and tough. But what's been interesting is the Nuggets have adapted to it the way that they've adapted to everything else that they faced in the playoffs. And they've gotten more comfortable playing against them. And that started in the second half of Game 2, and it carried over into Game 3. You mentioned that big run in the fourth quarter, but so much of that was the Lakers were selling out on double teams high. And yeah, you created turnovers and you got fast break points, and that's good for you. But if you don't get that, you're giving the Nuggets 4-on-3, which is doom. Do not do that routinely, or you're going to really get burned. The other thing is, if you take away the transition points, I looked it up on Cleaning the Glass. The Lakers' half-court offense has been pretty mediocre all year. Like, they don't have much in terms of firepower beyond LeBron and AD, and they don't shoot a lot of threes. They had a 92.6 offensive rating in the half-court last night. Oof. That's a problem. Like, that's a problem. And it's a more of a problem because you don't look at that number and go, like, well, I mean, as an outlier, they could do better. I don't know who else is going to step up for the Lakers. I still like the Lakers to win the series because they have LeBron and AD, and that defense is absolutely ferocious. But I am starting to get a little nervous for the Lakers in terms of how much the Nuggets have adjusted. And the Nuggets honestly have a few more options of what they can turn to. the Lakers' adjustment options are pretty slim unless somebody really gets hot shooting like Markieff Morris or Alex Caruso or one of those dudes. There are more options, I think, on the table for Denver than the Lakers, who are just going to have to rely on, we have Anthony Davis and LeBron James, and that's a pretty good thing to rely on. But the Clippers' whole thing was, we have Kawhi Leonard and Paul George, and that didn't work out great either.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, we saw the one adjustment they made last night was Dwight Howard started the second half, and I know people on Twitter were like, I wonder if we see JaVale McGee, and then I think it was TJ McBride who was like, yeah, you're going to see him when Dwight gets in foul trouble early in the third quarter, and then lo and behold, he got his fourth foul early in the third quarter. But, I mean, that's... Do you think that's something the Lakers turn to in game four, just starting Dwight Howard from the jump?
So I think Dwight did awesome in the first game and a half, but he's gotten a little too far into his role. Like him chirping at Joker, who's just like, okay, whatever, when he's reportedly was like, Batman's coming for you, the Joker. Like, Dwight, just play, buddy. You were a nice story, and everyone was excited and happy for you, and then you came out as an anti-masker, and are now trying to make very lame jokes. Like, just don't be Dwight for just a few more weeks, buddy. Just don't be you for a few more weeks. But I will say this, like, Joker has started running off screens, which makes Dwight uncomfortable, and he started playing in space. Joker's jump shot is in a great place right now, and they can run pick and pop, and Dwight's going to have a hard time with that. If they switch it, the Nuggets are going to be able to back down the smaller guy, force the double, and then Jokic can hit the cutter. There are options. They are... Again, the biggest thing with Joker is that for as talented as he is and as goofy looking as he looks, he's an exceptionally smart player. He solves guys. And I did not think that he was going to solve Dwight this soon. He has started to solve him. And that's, I think, is a real concern. I think if your options are, like, we really got to get, like, dominant play from Dwight Howard, that makes me a little bit nervous. They're going to need to get, I think, look, a lot of this, again, is just going to be Anthony Davis is going to have to play better. And he had 27 last night. So they're going to have to find other options. I think Dwight's going to continue to pick up foul trouble because he's way too amped up right now. He's overcommitting. And I think Jokic will continue to find ways to disrupt him on both ends of the floor.
Just a quick question, just to jump in, because you said, you talked about Nikola Jokic's jumper, that it's in a good place right now. Is that sustainable moving forward?
Yes. So if you actually, if you track him historically, like he's had seasons where he shot like 39% from three. His mid-range, like that Sombor shuffle, it looks ridiculous, and yet I've just seen it in person so many times that it never amazes me when it goes in. He's got exceptional touch. Like that's what he has insane touch on everything that he does. I don't think, he is not a guy that, as much as I don't like pick and pop mid-range options, he is not a guy that anytime that he takes that shot, I think it's a bad one. I don't think that's a losing proposition for the Nuggets. He can hit that consistently enough to drive him. Plus, he's got the floater and some other combos he can go to depending on how you play that pick and roll. The bigger question, I think, for me, if you want to talk about sustainability, is Anthony Davis. His jumper, I have a lot more questions about.
Yeah, and one thing, I mean, I don't think this will sustain, but, you know, Anthony Davis had two rebounds last night. JaVale McGee had one. Dwight Howard had one. They got out-rebounded as a team 44-25. I don't expect it to be that lopsided moving forward, but another sustainability question I have is Jeremy Grant, who played out of his mind really on both ends of the court last night. 26 points, 7 of 11 shooting, 12 free throw attempts, I think was the most eye-popping thing. And then Monte Morris off the bench, too, with 14 points on 5 of 7 shooting. Matt, that goes back to what you're talking about. You know, the Lakers have LeBron and AD. They combined for 57 points. And then the next highest scorer was Kentavious Caldwell-Pope with 12, Kyle Kuzma at 11. But, you know, you didn't really get a ton out of the supporting cast. Do you think this aggressive version of Jeremy Grant is here to stay?
No, I think the effort will be there, but I don't expect Grant to go off for more than 20 again. But if he can just give him 16, if he can give him 15, that's a big boost. And getting to the line was huge. So a lot of what the Lakers are doing is they're doing some of the stuff that the Clippers did, which is, all right, we're going to overload on Jokic and Murray pick and roll. And if we just shut that off, then everything will go away. The problem is that those two are such good passers, they will find other guys. And it has been that Grant will find that shot, and he's just been open for three. But if he's able to actually drive off the bounce, if he's able to drive off the catch, that puts another element, because even if he doesn't score, it means the defense has to rotate again, and then he can pass it to the corner to Harris, and then you have to rotate again, and then Harris can drive. When the Nuggets play that style, when it's pick and roll, force the help, kick, drive, that opens up all of their options, and then they become very difficult to beat. I don't expect Grant to have that kind of scoring performance, especially given that what was amazing about last night, I don't remember possessions where he guarded anybody except LeBron and AD. Like, he guarded the two best players for the Lakers in this series, two of the five best players maybe in the world, and he did it every single possession that he was on the floor, and he put up 26 points. So, phenomenal game by Grant, but I think you're only going to get one of those per series out of him.
Yeah. I guess the other question then is, you know, could you get a vintage Paul Millsap game at some point? Michael Porter Jr. is lurking there as well. Gary Harris, too. Like, do you think, you know, they can count on Jokic and Murray being dependable stars every night and their supporting cast, someone, whoever it is, coming through, you know, moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, they don't need much. Like, they really don't, given how, if they can, if they keep hold of the ball, don't turn it over, which is a big problem against a very good Lakers defense, and it's been a big problem for the Nuggets during the Jokic era. But if they don't turn the ball over to give up easy buckets, the Lakers' half-court offense is anemic enough that all you really have to do is get some contribution. I will never abandon Paul Millsap Island. I own, at this point, I have bought the majority of shares of plots on the island. I put in a mini mall. There's a nice yogurt stand at the end of the concourse. Please help yourself to a cucumber water. You know, I think he's probably got one more game left in him that he can provide some sort of offense. And, like, here's the thing with Millsap is he looks so bad now that when he hits two threes, he's that guy that, like, I always key in on these dudes that the opposing player or opposing fans on Twitter are like, that guy's killing us? Are you kidding me? And Paul Millsap is absolutely that guy. I think they have one MPJ game left. I think they have one more game where he can be that guy, but he's got to be able to have the trust of Malone. He was on court for 7 minutes in the second half and was a minus 15 during that fourth quarter run. And some of it was him, and some of it was how there's not a lot of confidence from his teammates in him. So these are all problems, but Malone's been good about not getting sucked into, all right, he just can't play, and keeping with him. He gives them too much offensively. If he's able to give them a kind of game that he can, like, it would not surprise me to see Porter go off for 30 at one point in the series. If they can win that game, then that gets them two. Mm-hmm. My big thing with this series is if they get this to game six, I like the Nuggets where they're at very much. Just get it to game six. Win one of the next two and get it to game six and make Anthony Davis, who has been out of the first round only once, and Kyle Kuzma and Alex Caruso and Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, everyone has acted like this Lakers team is playoff tested, and they're not. Put them in a high pressure situation in game six, and I think that leans in Denver's favor.
Yeah, I mean,
go ahead. Sorry, Brian.
Go.
Yeah, so you brought up turnovers, and I can't stop thinking about Monte Morris here, who's averaging 18 minutes per game in this series. Like, he's one of the premier ball handlers, not just for the Nuggets, but in the damn league. Should mm-hmm. should the Nuggets look to up his minutes total a little bit to maybe get some more secure possessions?
So the big thing with him is that it's feast or famine, and they have to limit his minutes a little bit, and here's why. If Gary Harris is going to get his normal allotment, which he will, and Jamal's obviously going to play 35 to 40 minutes a night, You can't have two small guards versus this Lakers team on the floor, because the Lakers figured out pretty quickly that they can attack and transition off makes so well. There were plays in the second in game two in the first half where they were just chucking the ball down to Kentavious Caldwell-Pope in transition, who would draw fouls, just not even getting to the rim, just the smaller guys can't contain him. So having Morris and Murray in the backcourt as two small dudes versus a very big Lakers team, you can find spot minutes for him, and I think that he leads that second unit really well, and it allows Jamal Murray to play off ball. So there are good minutes for him, but you have to be very judicious with how you use Morris because of that size differential. The other thing is that when Morris has been good in these playoffs, he's been awesome. And when he's been bad, he's been a nightmare. So it's like, it's not that his performance shifts, it's just the results. It's either he's knocking down threes and mid-range jumpers and is super confident in getting to the rim, or he can't find the bucket and he's he's tentative, and they're having 24-second violations. He doesn't turn the ball over, to your point, and that's why he'll continue to get minutes. But you have to be real careful with how much room you give Morris.
Interesting.
So, Matt, you correctly predicted that, you know, the Nuggets would come out in Game 3. You said this on Twitter, I think, right after Game 2. You know, the Nuggets have been an extremely resilient bunch, and you thought they would come out well in Game 3. They did. What's your prediction for Game 4?
LeBron comes out and has an absolutely thermonuclear game. LeBron has looked tired and old, but the problem with age is that it doesn't rob you of your ceiling, it robs you of your consistency. And we've seen this, that there are just a lot more games of like, oh, LeBron only had 16 points. Oh, LeBron didn't really play all that well in that game. He had a 30-point triple-double last night, but it didn't feel like he controlled the game. I'm expecting LeBron to absolutely control Game 4. I don't see him allowing the Nuggets to tie this up. Now, I think that's... The Nuggets are in a can't-lose situation. If they win, it's 2-2, and they're right in this thing. If they lose, they're down 3-1, and the Lakers are screwed. Mm-hmm. Speaking realistically, I do think LeBron wins the next game almost by himself, that the Nuggets will probably get a tough whistle. They probably won't hit threes. It'll be one of those games. And the Lakers come out up 3-1, and it comes down to Game 5. My prediction for the series is, this is how far I've thought it out in my head. My feeling is that the Lakers win Game 4, the Nuggets win Game 5, and the Lakers very barely win Game 6.
Yeah, I just hope, I know you've been in these pressers, if the Lakers do win Game 4, I want you to ask Mike Malone, do you have him right where you want him now?
Yep. I asked him going into the series, my first question to him in the pre-series presser was, yeah, coach, what's your plan for getting down 3-1 in this series? And he responded, he was like, yeah, you know, we petitioned the league to just let us start 3-1 so we could just go ahead and go from there, but they wouldn't go for it.
We're one game away. He might get his wish.
Mm-hmm.
So, guys, let's pivot now because there was more news that came out yesterday. Billy Donovan, surprisingly, is the new coach of the Chicago Bulls. And Mort, this is your former / maybe current team. Did this restore your faith in the Bulls a little bit?
It's a good hire, I think. They need some experience for a change. I mean, the Bulls have been notorious about hiring new, untested coaches, at least without prior NBA head coaching experience, at least. So this is a change of pace. I mean, since 1985, if it was Stan Elbeck, Scott Skiles, and who else? Yeah, now Billy Donovan. So that's the three. Yeah, this is a different look. I was kind of surprised, to be honest with you, because I was under the assumption that he actually did not want to go into a rebuild with the Oklahoma City Thunder, and I would definitely argue that the Bulls are still very much in a rebuild. So I was kind of surprised by that logic, and maybe he just decided that was a situation that attracted him. But yeah, that definitely caught me off guard. But I think for the Bulls, and especially for their youngsters, this is a really good get.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the rebuild point, because I saw a lot of that on Twitter when the hire got announced. And the thing I would push back on is, like, yes, both teams are rebuilding. Or, I mean, the Thunder, we'll see what happens, but they've given all the signals that they plan to rebuild. But I think they're in, like, very different stages of their rebuild, where the Thunder are going to take a step backward before they take a step forward. Whereas the Bulls, in theory, on paper, have an enticing young core that they just didn't maximize because Jim Boylan was a very bad coach. But, like, there is immediate upside here, whereas I think the Thunder, you know, you look 2 or 3 years down the line, and sure, they have all these draft picks, they have SGA, they have Dort, they have Darius Bazley. Like, there's something interesting there, but are you sure you're going to be the coach to get to coach those draft picks once they come up? I don't necessarily think so. But Matt, what were your thoughts on the hire?
So on the surface, it seems surprising, but then I thought about it more, and it makes a lot more sense. I don't think that the team is as much in a rebuild as people think. I think Boylan, you mentioned, I think Boylan made this team so much worse. They were the one team, so I bet they're over on wins in the preseason, and there was a lot of reason to believe that there was value there. The Bulls wound up 9th in defensive rating, and they still went 22-43. With Zach LaVine, They had the ninth best defense and still went 22-43. Do you know how stupid of a coach, I'm sorry, how much of a coach you have to struggle as in order for that to be the case? Like, it was just so apparent when you watch the Bulls, you're just like, this team should be way better on offense. They have all these weapons. They have all these guys. Why are they not better on offense? This is mind-boggling. And if you actually, like, if you dig into the roster, and you're like, okay, Zach LaVine's not, like, a super young player that you're rebuilding around him. I don't know long-term if he'll be there. Like, I would tell you that the people that I know would say that he is not an Arturas Karnisovas-type player. However, if you look at, like, how LaVine clashed with Boylan, Donovan's perfect because he preaches accountability, but he supports guys. He has that college mentality of loving them up and demanding accountability. And doing both of those things at once is the best thing you can do in the modern NBA. Don't let them run wild. Don't be, just show up and play and I don't care, the George Karl approach. That doesn't work anymore. You also can't be Boylan on so many levels. Just so many levels you can't be Jim Boylan. But Donovan will be very supportive. He'll instill principles. And he'll keep being like, you can be great if we do this. We can be great if you do these things. I think Wendell Carter Jr. is going to benefit a lot from this. I think Otto Porter is going to benefit a lot from this if he stays healthy. I think Lauri Markkanen is going to benefit a lot from this if he stays healthy. I think Kobe White's going to benefit a lot from this. Like, all of these players I look at and go, oh yeah, Donovan's a good coach for him. Like, all those guys. So I'm very high on the Bulls now. I think that combined with whatever they come out of in the draft, they're going to be. I would expect them to be much improved next season, much closer to 500.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, do you guys think more? I guess I'll throw this to you. Do you think he's the right coach to get them back to a championship level, or do you think this is kind of like the he's going to get us from bad to good, and then we might, you know, he could, I don't want to compare him to Mark Jackson because that's unfair, but you know, that type of coach where it's like he could get us back into the playoffs, but a couple years down the line we're going to need someone to push us over the edge.
I think that's just, it's way too soon to answer that question. He's been in the league 5 years. That Thunder team was always so, you know, hot and cold and major roster turnover. So it's a good question, and it's something that needs to be answered ultimately, but right now, I don't know. It's the best answer I can give you.
I have thoughts.
Fire away, Matt.
So, bear in mind that in his first season, and I know it's going to be like, well, yeah, Kevin Durant, he took a team that had been used to Scotty Brooks, that trusted Scotty Brooks, that loved Scotty Brooks, that had been together a while. He got them to 3-1 up against the Warriors in the Western Conference Finals. He is Klay Thompson going thermonuclear away from having made the finals in his first season with the Thunder, and maybe everything changes. He didn't miss the playoffs with OKC. Made it every year. They competed really well every single season, despite the fact that, like, that first season after KD left, they were in, like, they had no money, they had no room, they had no time to recover after KD left. Like, they had no time to recover from that to rebuild. Yes, Russ had that ridiculous triple-double season, which that was mostly what the year was about. They still won enough games. They still won enough games to make the playoffs. They have, and then with this year, he was able to take that core, and they were one of the, like, after the first month of the season, the Thunder were one of the best teams in the league for the rest of the year. And they still dragged Houston to 7 games. Like, Billy Donovan is, I've found, is to be a really good regular season coach, and I do not have any reason to believe that he's not a good playoffs coach. Like, he hasn't lost a series where, he lost one series, the Portland series, where he really should have won. But in both the Portland series and the Jazz series, most of that was Russ got his head too far up his ass about it and, like, really cost him. And I'm a Russ guy, but that was just, he got into a personal thing with Ricky Rubio. Paul George was hurt versus the Jazz. Like, all these things happened. But I think Billy Donovan, I'll just put it this way. I think you can absolutely win a title with Billy Donovan at coach. I don't think that this Bulls team will, because I don't see the roster having the guy yet. But
right.
I absolutely think that if they had the right team, they could win a championship with Billy Donovan.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, I look at the Houston series this year, and, like, there were some things that were a little eyebrow-raising in terms of lineup choices. Like, it felt like he didn't necessarily maximize what he could have been doing, especially, you know, going with the three guards plus Dort plus Gallo a little bit more. But I think it's a fair point, Matt, that, you know, he wasn't really, that Thunder team wasn't expected to do anything this year. So they significantly overachieved relative to expectations. And I think another good sign, at least if you're a Bulls fan, is, you know, Zach LaVine was streaming I forget what game he was playing, but you know, he was streaming when he got the news, and like, he seemed pumped. And guys around the league too, like Bradley Beal seemed excited. I mean, it seems like a good thing that, you know, you're getting buy-in not only from your own players, which I don't necessarily know they ever had with Boylan, but I'm not saying Bradley Beal's going to be a Chicago Bull anytime soon, but you know, the fact he has all of those ties with so many Florida players can only help the Bulls, both in terms of, you know, getting their own players to actually not actively hate their coach, and then maybe down the line in terms of trades, free agency, who knows what.
Well, to be fair, I mean, look, Zach LaVine would have you know, celebrated the hiring of a teddy bear if it means not having Boylan there. Yeah. So it's, yeah.
That's fair. That's fair. All right, let's pivot, guys, into the Eastern Conference Finals. We have Game 4 tonight. Miami is up 2-1. Gordon Hayward returned in Game 3, played 31 minutes off the bench, which I would not have expected after a month layoff, but had 6 points, 5 rebounds, 4 assists, 3 steals, played an all-around pretty nice game. Matt, do you think the return of Hayward flips this series on its head a little bit?
I do. I think he's a zone breaker. I think that he's able to pass so well when he catches, when they overload on one side, that it helps. I think his transition play, the defense, having a bigger body to be able to counter some of the Heat size, I think is really big. I like the Celtics in the series from the start. I think that they should be up 2-1 right now. I noticed that in the quarters in the first two games that the Celtics lost, so they clearly played like garbage, right? Like turning the ball over, sloppy, got late in the shot clock, couldn't do anything. Like they just played horrible for those random stretches where they got away from their game plan. At the exact same time that was happening, the Heat didn't play well. The Heat put up an offensive rating that was above 160 in 3 of the quarters that they won in those two games. Like, like, I get it. The Heat are really good. They have a really good offense. But to time it perfectly like that, I have a little bit of question marks over. The Celtics have won 8 of the 12 quarters in the series. Getting Hayward back helps them a lot in terms of tilting things. I like Boston a lot to win this series.
More, what do you think that you need to see out of the Heat in Game 4 to help them get this 3-1 lead?
You know, I honestly just think they should keep doing what they're doing. They're pressing good. They're scoring at a high rate. They're using Bam the right way. They kind of went away from the post up because that was inefficient, and he's what I really like is the way they use Bam, and I think they need to go to that. You know, he makes a quick screen, he rolls, he catches us quickly, he makes a decision quickly, he doesn't stand around a whole lot. So I think that needs to be it, and then Goran Dragic needs to be him, really. I mean, the fact that he's gotten the green light for the playoffs and he's delivered the way that he has, he's been given the minutes, it seems to be working. But I do agree with Matt, though. The Celtics are lurking, and I would be scared.
Yeah. I mean, if nothing else, you know, Jay Crowder has been sensational from 3 throughout really the entire bubble. But Game 2 went 3 of 10. Game 2, 3 of 10. Game 3, 2 of 10. If he comes crashing back and regressing to the mean right now, that could be a big swing factor too, because I mean, you know, you can't necessarily bank on his outlier shooting, but maybe you thought this is just him in the bubble, and the bubble's a shooter's environment, and he's just gonna hit a higher volume of threes than he had, because I mean, that's a shot that the Celtics are willing to concede. They don't mind Jay Crowder taking 10 threes a game because they figure the percentages will regress to the mean. So that's something I'm keeping an eye on heading into this game. So, Matt, you said you were pro-Boston heading into the series, and I think, you know, bringing up them winning 8 of 12 quarters is a pretty convincing argument. So what do you see happening in Game 4?
Yeah, I mean, I just think the Celtics win. I think the Celtics win this game. I actually wouldn't be surprised if they reverse sweep the Heat. Now, the Heat have proven me wrong in this series, again, based off of the ridiculous shooting and the Celtics play. Like, it's going 7 wouldn't shock me in Miami winning just because they took those two games that I don't think that they necessarily, quote-unquote, should have won. They, you know, you win the games you win. But I don't like this matchup. I just don't. I think that the Celtics have so many options of what they can do. Tice is playing well. I think that the Heat got two pretty rough Kemba Walker games. I think Kemba's got more in the bank. I think that Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum have more in the bank. Like, they have more firepower. I trust their defense more. I trust their role players more. I like Boston to win at least three of the next four.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, Jaylen, you saw after the game two kerfuffle that happened in the locker room between Smart and Jaylen, and, you know, objects being thrown, whatever. Jaylen definitely came out in game three and seemed more aggressive from the jump, finished with 26 points on 11 of 17 shooting, 7 rebounds, 5 assists, 3 steals, just like an all-around dynamo performance from him. So if Marcus Smart yelling at him after the game is what's going to unlock this version of Jaylen Brown, then yeah, I think you probably do have to feel pretty good about Boston's chances. But Mort, what do you think?
Yeah, I love Jaylen Brown. You and I have talked a lot about Jaylen Brown on this podcast. If he comes out and gives it that same push, that's a huge asset. I mean, he's one of the most incredible defenders in the league right now, as far as I'm concerned. He's so aggressive. He's so smart. And when he brings it up offensively, like, takes that same energy level on offense, it takes so much pressure away from Jason Tatum, takes pressure away from Kemba Walker, it opens up the entire floor. Now that Gordon Hayward is back, you add in his playmaking, there's so much to like there.
Yeah. I mean, I think the Heat genuinely just might need a monster Jimmy Butler game, which...
It feels like they need it, right? I mean, they haven't had it.
Yeah.
This series.
Right. I mean, he had 13 shot attempts in game three, which, you know, I mean, it's... They've used that formula at times and have been successful. But, you know, game two, he only had 14 points. But, like, I think they need, you know, a 25-30 spot from Jimmy here. Like, he needs to set the tone offensively from the tip and hunt for his shot more than he tends to with this team. But we'll see what happens. Guys, let's wrap up with some talk about the MVP race here, because I think it was on Friday it was announced that Giannis, to absolutely no one's surprise, has won MVP for the second straight year. And LeBron James came out and said it pissed him off. He, you know, some candid comments from LeBron James. Matt, you are, you know, back in your CBS Sports days, I remember the 2016-17 season, I think, was the Russ Harden Kawhi debate that you published like a 10,000 word opus in terms of who should win, baking the case for all of them. So you were one of the most devoted MVP followers, I think, in the basketball blogosphere. What did you think about, you know, Giannis winning, A, and whether LeBron has a legitimate gripe here?
LeBron's being ridiculous. First off, would you be happier that you lost by a handful of votes? Would that make you feel better? Two, you know, you got all the second place votes. Like, you got 16 first place votes, you got all the second place votes. Everyone thought that you were very worthy. It's not like anybody doesn't think that you're good. Third, he tried to make the argument of, like, well, the MVP is just decided by narrative. Dude, the entire argument for you is narrative. Everyone goes, like, well, he's doing this at 35 years old. As if that matters. It doesn't matter how... You don't get bonus points for being old. I'm 38. Guess what? You don't get bonus points for being old. You don't get bonus points for, like, oh, but he took this franchise, this iconic franchise. No. We know that the Lakers are special in the NBA and are treated differently, and that's fine, but we don't actually have to vote that way. Like, that's preposterous. And then, you know, finally, like, oh, and, like, to go through everything and, like, what he's done. Like, look, it's great. On-court stuff is what matters. It just does. And LeBron was awesome on defense this year. He reinvested himself after 4 years in Cleveland of really not giving a damn defensively. And it's been impressive to see what he's done with this Lakers team. I think he's been awesome. He's been incredible. He absolutely deserved to win runner-up. Giannis had one of the most dominant offensive seasons that we've ever seen. And it's like, if you want to factor in the playoffs, you need to have them vote after the playoffs are over. I'm fine with that. You want to do that? Fine. If you want to create a best player in the league award, I'm fine with that too. But when you talk about most valuable player, the performance is based off of the performance of the season. It's not most valuable player of the last couple of years. It's not most valuable player esoterically. Like, its most valuable player in terms of the performance on the season. The Bucks won the most games. Giannis had the most dominant season. It's not made for the playoffs. Everyone saw the Heat upset coming a mile away. No one's surprised. LeBron is awesome. He's either the second or first best player in NBA history. I get that he wants to win one more MVP. I hope he wins one more. I think it'd be an awesome thing for him to win four. You're going to have to get there. Like, sorry, you're just going to have to get there. You don't get bonus points for being old or playing for the Lakers. Giannis should have won. LeBron's being ridiculous about this.
Yeah. Mort, I figured this would appeal to you because LeBron specifically brought up, you know, what the criteria is. His exact comment was, I'm not going to sit up here and talk about what the criteria should or should be or what it is. It's changed over the years since I've gotten into the league. Sometimes it's the best player on the best team. Sometimes it's the guy with the best season statistically. Sometimes, I mean, you don't know, but you know, Giannis had a hell of a season. I can definitely say that. And this has been your gripe really every time we've done an awards podcast, not only with MVP, really with pretty much every award here. So can you at least sympathize with that perspective from LeBron, or are you also team like he's being ridiculous here?
Oh, he's being ridiculous, but that doesn't mean I still can't agree with the overall point of the criteria, which I think shifts a lot. And I would be interested, Matt, because you are so more into this than I am in terms of the awards. Like, how do you feel about, you know, the awards in a vacuum in terms of how they should be gauged and how they should be viewed? I mean, does it come down to stats? Is it a combination of stats, best player on best team, narrative? Like, how do you separate it?
I think every voter has to determine what they value, and I think that that's why I'm fine with the narrative voters. I think that there's a place for narrative voters in the award. Like, I think that it's good to have I don't want a voting block that's just analytic wonk analysts.
Right.
Or I don't want them just to be former players. I don't want it to be just studio heads. I don't want it to be just TV reporters who have a lot to gain from being friendly with certain people and their agents. I think it's good to have like a wide cross of these things in order to get like the best view of it. I think for everyone, I've said this before, one of my favorite articles I write every year is like, what are the questions you have to ask yourself about MVP? And a lot of it with this year was, how much do you value winning? Lakers were number one team in the Western Conference, but the Bucks had a better record against the Western Conference than the Lakers did. Bucks won by more. The Bucks had a better record. So it's like, if it was just the numbers, then sure. But there wasn't just the numbers. It was also everything else. I think when you look at Giannis's cast, and like, I think Chris Middleton is underrated and should have been all NBA. I don't think there's any, like, there's just, I don't understand how he wasn't all NBA. At the same time, you compare Chris Middleton and Anthony Davis, and it's just different. If LeBron wanted to win MVP, maybe don't trade for a top five player in the league, because you're automatically going to get hit with, you have more help than the other guy does. Like, if that's your priority, you shouldn't do that, you know? And it's like, you should be able to win even though you have good teammates. I don't like punishing guys for good teammates. That seems ridiculous. But I do think that on some level, what Giannis did in the context of what his team is was more valuable than what LeBron did in the context of what his team did, very slightly. It was close.
Right.
It was absolutely close. But I do think that for me, I got the vote one time before I left CBS and then have not gotten the vote back since. The way I've defined it is most impactful, because that's what matters to me, is like, how much do you impact when you're on the court? When you're on the court, how good is your team? And the Lakers were really good with LeBron on the court, but the Bucks were much better when Giannis was on the court. And that was based off of metrics, but also just like wins and watching the games and everything else. And so that to me is like how it gets defined. I think it's good to have a cross-section of voters, but I also think that there's a reason why. I looked it up. I did a study on this. Since the media got the vote in 1980, the percentage of how much of the top vote possible the winning player has gotten has steadily risen, and it jumped immediately and has gotten higher on average in 3-year rolling averages. And so like what that means is media tends to all go in one direction, And the idea, the criticism of that is like, well, isn't that groupthink? And it's like, no, it's because you have a bunch of discerning people that eventually all come to the same conclusion because usually there's one answer. Like Westbrook, I think, is the exception to this rule where you can really make the argument that I voted for Harden, and I think you can make the argument for Kawhi. And I think that looking back on it, a bunch of people are like, yeah, with how Russ's triple-double antics look later, that doesn't hold up as well. But at the time, I get it because he made history and that Thunder team lost KD, and like that was a narrative vote. And so there's a lot that goes into this whole thing. But I do think that typically the media tends to all swing in one direction because there's a clear answer on board.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And that, just to clarify, when you say most impactful, this isn't like you just go to cleaning the glass and look at their on-off rating. And like that's the only thing, right? Like you're taking a number of metrics into account. That could be one of them, but it's also, you know, as you said, wins per game stats, like eye test, a whole like wide
right.
swath.
So like, if you're blowing out teams because you're putting up a 140 offensive rating, which is not sustainable, but if you were doing that, I would be like, well, what's your defense at? And if your defense, if you're giving up 120, I would be like, well, your defense isn't any good when you're on the court. Like, it's great that you're able to outscore everybody and that matters, but your defense isn't great. But with Giannis, like, you would notice, like, oh, they absolutely destroy teams offensively, and they have the best defense in the league. Like, he was defensive player of the year, and he was the most dominant. Like, he's the best player finishing at the rim. He has all these assists. He's a massive rebounder. Like, and then you can't just look at the numbers either. Like, when I do, you mentioned the stuff I did for CBS. I've carried that over. This is since 2015, the last six seasons. I have done, I watch every single possession that the players in contention play on both sides of the floor. Like, I go and I watch every single defensive possession. I go and I watch every single offensive possession. And it takes weeks to do this. It's thousands of possessions. But you pick up on patterns and you don't, I'm not like watching the same one over and over and over again. A lot of them are the same thing. Like, I've seen so many Harden lobs to Capella out of the pick and roll. If I never see it again, I'll be happy. but you pick up on a lot of what makes them great. Like, it makes you appreciate them. And you have to be able to back that up in order to say, look, I've seen the numbers. This is provided a baseline, but the eye test matches this. These are in cohesion.
Right. Mm-hmm. Oh, I have a question for that, because sometimes you actually talk to Kevin Durant on Twitter. You guys have some back and forth. It's an interesting perspective when he comes in and talks about the game, you know, from a player's perspective. Has that in any way changed your approach to how you gauge basketball at all?
No, because I didn't really disagree with him to begin with. Like, say here's the thing. It's like, if KD right. brought something to the table that I didn't know, then I'll definitely incorporate that. The big thing I think I need to note is, like, KD pops into my mentions because he follows me the way that he pops into a lot of people's mentions. And I try and, like, make this very evident. Like, look, he talks with the Rockets blog, Dream Shake. Like, he will talk with anybody if he sees it on his timeline. He's into that. He's an egalitarian, as far as that goes. I think there's a lot that I would learn from Kevin Durant from talking to him. I know that. If you ask me, because this was something that actually upset me. Like, I adore Doris Burke, and she's a queen and amazing and like just awesome. She called. She didn't know who I was, and she called me out. Even though we've met before, but she called me out on Twitter, like subtweeted me basically during the broadcast when that happened, and said like, "I can't imagine telling Kevin Durant what shots he could take." And I'm like, "I never told Kevin Durant what shots he could take. I would never do that because Kevin Durant's good at every single shot on the floor. I also wouldn't tell Andrew Wiggins that because Andrew Wiggins has earned where he's at. But if Andrew Wiggins would be like, "Why do you think I'm not considered as good as I think I am?" I'd be like, because you take a lot of these shots that you're not very good at, and you should take more shots that you're really good at because you're a really good player because you're in the NBA. I try and be like very open to these ideas, and like when KD jumps in, it's this weird thing where you have to either immediately back down and go like, well, you're the player and you know everything, or you have to be like, all right, I'll banter with you a little bit. And so like I've bantered just because if he wants, I don't think he doesn't want a challenge on some of this stuff. I think there's a lot to learn from what, like, every time I've gotten answers from Durant that are good, when I've talked to him in media settings, it's been really good. I asked him once, about the balance of offense and defense and about how you have to learn to manage your effort level. And he was like, that's a really good question that nobody really talks about. in that you have to really learn how to save your energy on the defensive end for the offensive end. And there are nights when you have to do the opposite and you have to be like, I'm going to play a little bit more off ball because I got a big assignment on defense I have to manage. He's like, and you have to be able to know your body really well in order to know how to do that. So he has, like, I think he's really insightful and there's a lot to learn, but usually the things that we're arguing about are things that we typically agree on anyway. His whole thing is just players should shoot whatever shots that they feel comfortable with. And my thing is like, I would agree with you, except for the fact that their teams suck and nobody thinks these players are good because they're struggling. So there's clearly something wrong. And if I want every player to be the best that they can be and every team to be the best they can be, and right. Zach LaVine's teams would be a lot better if he shot more threes. Like, there's just no real argument against that. If you can prove that you can, here's my thing. If you can prove that you can shoot 50% from mid-range, you can take as many as you want. Kevin Durant can shoot 50% from mid-range. Kevin Durant can shoot as many as he wants. Kawhi yeah. Leonard, same deal. But there's a reason the Spurs struggle. It's because LaMarcus Aldridge is a really good mid-range shooter, but he only shoots 44%, which the math doesn't wind up working out in your favor.
Yeah. I don't know if you guys saw, KD was on JJ Redick's podcast recently, and they were talking about the awards stuff and kind of like, you know, just taking issue with some of the people who made, I think it was the all defensive team. And, you know, KD even said like, man, there is some defensive players of the year. And I'm pretty sure he was subtweeting Rudy Gobert here. He's like, you know, these guys get played off the floor. Like, I could score easily over these guys. So it is really interesting to think about the difference of opinion between players and media. And Matt, I still remember the piece you did years ago with Andre Iguodala, where you like sat down and he just walked you through some defensive possessions. And it was just like so elucidating to get his perspective. I forget who did it for The Athletic recently, but they did that with Brook Lopez as well, explaining like how he stays in the paint for 2.9 seconds before, you know, doesn't get a 3 second violation, but like the key to their entire defense was he lurks in there as long as possible beforehand. So, you know, for all the content creators out there who have access to players, more of this, please. It's always just really, really entertaining, but also educational.
Yeah. And Iguodala was just a really smart dude, and he was willing to actually go into detail, which was great. In that he taught me a lot of stuff. Like, I asked him, who's the best perimeter defender in the NBA? And it was a softball question for him to be like, well, it's me. Mm-hmm. And he's a pretty like confident dude. This was 2013 at the time, and he was like, it's Drew Holiday. And I was like, what? I was like, what? And he was like, Drew's a dog. Drew is a dog. He will hound you 90 feet. I've seen him check Derrick Rose from sideline to sideline, from baseline to baseline. So there's a lot of things that are I think you can learn from that kind of stuff.
And KD just named Drew Holiday as the best guard defender, so I guess not much has changed 7 years later. Well, Matt, thank you again for joining us. Please, could you just let our listeners know on Twitter where they can find you on Twitter and where they can find your work?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at HP Basketball, and make sure to check out the Action Network app wherever you get your applications.
Good stuff. Yes, please follow Matt. In the meantime, also, please follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bios, so give us a follow as well. You can find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews. And we are being hosted by Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Until next time, I'm Brian Toporek, and I was joined, as always, by Morten Jensen and by our special guest, Matt Moore, the senior NBA writer at the Action Network. Have a good one, guys. Enjoy Game 4 tonight.
You too, man.
Thanks, guys.